Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, the first in our series of two-hour special programs from the International Conference Global Health, A Bridge to the Future. Recently, a small group of global leaders in health and development met at Boston University to consider the future of health. The conference approached the topic from four thematic areas: creativity, identity, urbanization, and institutions. Tonight we hear excerpts from the opening day's plenary session. We begin with an introduction by Boston University President Robert Brown.
It's really wonderful to welcome you here, to have you with us at Boston University, and for BU to be the host of this meeting on global health, A Bridge to the Future. We're indebted to Jerry Kirsch and his colleagues in the University Global Health Initiative for the vision, for organizing this meeting, and for the enormous effort he's put in. I also want to thank the colleagues in the Pardee Institute, Pardee Center at Boston University, for their sponsorship of the event as well. We're also very grateful to other outside sponsors, the Gates Foundation, Fred Pardee and the Pardee Center, and Alan Leventhal, the chairman of the Board of Trustees at Boston University, who all contributed to this meeting. I came to Boston University from MIT, very excited about the commitment on the medical campus and on the commitment at Charles River campus specifically in playing a major role in global health. This commitment is strong in the School of Public Health, but as you will hear, there are faculty all across Boston University with deep interest in a full range of issues, including economic development, urban development, medical research, healthcare systems and education, and the role of institutions and governments. Finally, I have a very special interest and a particular personal interest in the role of institutions of higher education like Boston University in addressing global health issues. What is the role of universities in these critical questions today, and why is that different from where it's been before? Today, more than any time in history, universities are playing a unique role in our society. Historically, universities have always been centers of excellent scholarship and learning. In the past, the focus has been on education and sometimes on an insular perspective on society, which has caused the ivory tower image of universities. This is not the view of modern research universities today, which must strive to be an open learning community built around the energy for knowledge creation and global societal and economic impact. Boston University is striving to be such a university and to do so as a member of the global community. And this effort is led by faculty all across the university. The Global Health Initiative, which has organized this meeting, and the Pardee Center are core organizations in this effort. It involves academic units in the medical school, such as the School of Public Health, and departments and programs in the College of Arts and Sciences. One outstanding new commitment of the School of Medicine in Boston University is in the area of infectious disease. The National Emerging Infectious Disease Laboratory in NEDLE is the manifestation of that effort. Under the leadership of Mark Klempner, the Associate Provost of Research of the Medical School, the NEDLE will bring together an absolutely unique set of researchers and facilities for the intensive study of infectious disease in a world-class facility on our campus. It is our dream that the research carried out here by BU faculty and our collaborators will unlock the secrets of deadly infections, known and unknown, and that working with colleagues around the world, we can have a major impact on global health. Although infectious disease is a critical part of the picture of global health, it is by no means the only thing. There are so many other challenges that we need to address: clean water, health care distribution and education, economic development and infrastructure. I hope we can find ways for BU faculty and students to contribute to these challenges. This meeting has brought together a wonderful collection of talent from all across the world to consider issues ranging across this full range of topics. With your experience, unique perspectives, and the marvelous amount of creativity in the room, I know that there'll be significant progress from this meeting and that you will have a lasting impact. Thank you very much.
My name is Gerald Kirsch. I'm Assistant Provost for Global Health at the Medical Campus and the Associate Dean for Global Health at the School of Public Health. Welcome to this inaugural meeting of the Global Health Initiative at Boston University. This plenary session is the first major activity of the Global Health Initiative at Boston University. Global Health Initiative, or the GHI, is working on a strategy that will lead to a truly cross-university program in behalf of our students, our faculty, and importantly, our global collaborators around the world. And the idea is, as Dr. Brown said, is to create an interactive and interdisciplinary educational program associated with research as well as service and policy outreach in the arena of global health. It's based on the premise that health is at the essential core of individual and societal development, and that if we are to succeed as a global community into the future, health equity must replace health disparities as the norm. And it's our goal to contribute to achieving this by helping to educate a generation of globally literate citizens who understand the essential connectivity among people around the world as academics and as advocates. This conference is the first that I know of to take a longer-range future perspective. There are certainly current crises that need to be addressed, and near-term priorities and plans are obviously important. But we also need to be systematically looking ahead to ensure that we begin to put into place now what we'll need to achieve our goals by mid-century. The conference is also unique in that the subsequent 2 days of discussion among the global leaders participating will focus on big issues and not individual diseases. So we're discussing creativity and not Alzheimer's disease. We're focusing on health and identity at the genomic, at the individual, and at the community and societal level. We're talking about urbanization as one way of approaching the issues of population growth and environmental ravage. And finally, whether or not the national and international institutions that are in place to try to deal with the challenges of improving health and reducing disparities are up to the job, and whether or not they can evolve to meet the needs that will face us 4 or 5 decades down the road. So this plenary session was organized to ask the question, when we talk about global health, what do we mean? And what will global health mean by 2050? To do this, we've asked a group of outstanding individuals who have been thinking about these issues and acting on them for many years to come up and give us their best ideas as they would approach that topic. What does it mean when we talk about global health? What is health all about? And what is it going to be like in 2050? It's not to come to any conclusions. It's to put ideas out on the table because we need to discuss and have dialogue around what we mean. We need to come to consensus about what those goals are and how we're going to approach them. With that as a brief introduction of what the Global Health Initiative is trying to do and why this conference has come about, it's my pleasure now to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Bernard Kouchner. Dr. Kouchner is known to many in the audience. He is a French physician and is a co-founder of the organization Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. He served as France's health minister and during that period of time thought deeply about how to provide health services to all and redress disparities in healthcare that existed within France. And was in this position until he was selected by the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to be his special representative in Kosovo. As the founder and the president of Médecins Sans Frontières, Dr. Kouchner has traveled extensively in all troubled areas of the world, has organized humanitarian operations to places like Somalia, El Salvador, Lebanon, Vietnam, and others. And together with his colleagues at MSF, he shared the 1999 Nobel Prize for Peace for the extraordinary humanitarian work of MSF. Please welcome Bernard Kouchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, I'm very honored to be facing you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, distinguished guests invited. We all know the state of affairs, and we have no time to go to the details of the danger we are facing. AIDS, of course, HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and all the simple and killing diseases targeting children, women, etc. And, of course, the water problem, environment problems. We all know about the lack of infrastructures and the necessity of well-trained professionals. We know how costly it is to tackle these problems. How heavy are the necessary investments. So what is global health? It is, according to my opinion, the most important challenge of the period. It needs not only professionals, but activists to offer a moral answer, yes, but also personal engagement. Because the answer is politic. But the medical staff is reluctant about politics. It had always been the case when we created Doctors Without Borders, we were called the EPs of medicine or Doctor Without Diploma. It has changed a bit because we received the Nobel Prize for Peace. But, you know, let's say the official, the conservative doctors in France, they were considering that we were not serious. But public health is not neutral. Public health is politics. It is a political activity, and in the good sense of the word, not in the sense of winning in elections, on the contrary, but to offer a better world to all the children of the planet. Neither virus nor germs used to respect the borders. Global health is a political problem. And nothing is more revealing of the world's inequalities than various existing level of health. Nothing is more unbearable than the difference in access to health. Nothing could be simpler or more urgent than to use the positive side of globalization and another time to set up patient without borders after doctor without borders. And it may be the only positive side of globalization for now. It was not imaginable 10 years behind us to start offering antiretrovirus treatment to AIDS patients, to consider that the suffering of patients were the same across the borders, despite of the color of skins, the religion of the people, or the color or the level of their economic values. Impossible to hope to share part of the money coming from rich countries with poor persons. Some 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was not imaginable. And now we have the Global Fund, the World Bank, some foundations, a lot of very powerful NGOs and national efforts. We are, I believe, too slowly making some progress. But our moral and medical duty impose us to be impatient, perpetually impatient. Let's underline some problems. The modern human rights framework can provide a new movement of health professionals with the necessary instruments and modes of action to uncover and act open the societal foundation for disease, disability, and death. Jonathan Mann, a close friend with whom the so-called French doctors used to work, and the founding director of François-Xavier Bagnou Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard School of Public Health, was right. Here we are. Activists, we must remain. We are not only thinking about statistics. This is too easy. And at the end, these global numbers do not represent anything for the people. But we are mostly interested in human beings. While a baby born in Japan today can expect to live about 85 years, a girl born in the same moment, at the same moment in Sierra Leone, has a life expectancy of 36 years. The Japanese child will receive vaccination services, adequate nutrition, and good schooling. If she becomes a mother, she will benefit from high-quality maternity care. Growing older, she may eventually develop chronic diseases, but excellent treatment and rehabilitation services will be available. She can expect to receive an average medication worth about $550 a year. In my country, this is $2,000 a year. And much more if needed. Meanwhile, the girl in Sierra Leone has a little chance of enjoying any immunization and a high probability of being underweight throughout childhood. She will probably marry in adolescence and go on to give birth to six or more children without assistance from a trained midwife. One or more of her babies will die in infancy, and she herself will suffer a high risk of dying during childbirth. If she falls ill, she can expect an average medication about $3 a year. If she survives middle age, she too will develop chronic diseases, but without access to adequate treatment. She will die prematurely. You know, neither life nor public health is only about statistics. Now some questions. First point. There is indeed a strong international commitment to global health, shown by the central role of Millennium Development Goals in the Development Dialogue. UN Summit, G8 financial support committed to scaling up health services. 2005 enjoyed a rejuvenation of global interest in development and health especially. LifeAid, the Commission for Africa report, Millennium Project report, as well as the G8 and 2005 Millennium Plus 5 Summit, place development back on political agenda in rich countries. But the agenda is not a reality. This achievement was added to unprecedented public donation and compassion in the wake of tsunami. However, the food crisis in Niger and Pakistan earthquake suffered from an inoperative media effect and a far less compassion. But the percentage of GDP devoted to development in many rich countries is always too low, far from what has been promised. Developing countries may have reason to be cynical, as Millennium Development Goals have been on the agenda for 5 years. Major donor assistance has been promised, particularly this year, but little has been delivered. People sitting in this room have the power to influence political leaders into turning commitment into action. How serious are participants about achieving this? Are we on the crest of the wave and will interest soon dwindle away? Are new commitments serious? And what is the role of the public opinion? Are they happy to share their budget with foreigners? In my country, they are not. Do developing countries also feel that there has been a sea change in development thinking this year, or this is a Western delusion? Are bilateral and multilateral donations able to provide development aid for health on a longer term? and less volatile basis, thus allowing countries to expand health services such as treatment of HIV/AIDS. Second point, money is one of the blockages for countries trying to reach the Millennium Development Goals. We must monitor G8 commitments and ensure that the promised $50 billion increase in donor assistance is realized. But even if sufficient resources become available, as promised, improved health results would not automatically be achieved. Increased aid needs to be matched with a better aid. This includes more long-term predictable aid without burdensome conditions so that countries can make long-term plans to scale up. Political commitments, open governance, efficient management, and a performant culture are important factors that countries need to address to improve absorptive capacity. Last point, collaboration among development partners. Most people would agree the harmonization among bilateral and multilateral development partners to work jointly in achieving improved health is desirable. But this may not be the case in reality. To that extent, does harmonization take place at the national level? No. Harmonization among NGOs? No. Are development agencies sometimes more in competition rather than really cooperating? Yes, they are. Medicine cannot be sliced up. Creating hope and developing health care are the only remedies for achieving prevention as well as reaching Millennium Development Goals and scaling up. We must therefore develop together common strategy for maternal, neonatal, and infant health programs, as well as finance and environmentally friendly programs, gender equality, and reducing poverty. And finally, I can't tell you finally because it was on human rights and I have no time. Just to let you know that the definition, the naive definition of WHO, which was health is a complete state of physical and mental well-being, is not serious. We know that. No one aware of the state of the world, permanent tension and enforcement of inequality could accept such a simplistic and mechanical definition. And just to end, I rather prefer the definition of the French philosopher Georges Canguilhem. Health is a resistance to oppression, a capacity to be ill, and a building of values. Thank you very much.
Next on our program is Vice Admiral Richard Carmona, the Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Carmona is the 17th Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service and brings to his position, which is to advocate for the better health of the American public and the larger world we live in, a breadth of experience in his own career in emergency medicine, surgery, public health, family and community medicine, much of it at the University of Arizona. I regret to say Dr. Carmona has been unexpectedly called away and is not able to be here in person. But he's taken the time to prepare a brief video, which we will show in a moment. And he's asked a close colleague and friend, Rear Admiral Jerry Michael, to provide additional perspective in his stead. Dr. Michael is a former Assistant Surgeon General and for two decades was the Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of Hawaii. It's a nice assignment. He currently teaches public health at the George Washington University School of Public Health. And importantly, he served on a task force organized by Surgeon General Carmona to develop a call for action for global health, and which we have been anticipating its release for many months now. So I'll ask Rear Admiral Michael to come to the podium after the video is shown. So could we run Surgeon General Carmona's video, please?
Hello, I'm Vice Admiral Richard Carmona, the United States Surgeon General. I'm sorry that I can't be with you today in Boston. Unfortunately, I was called away on a last-minute assignment. But you'll be happy to know, along with Secretary Leavitt, I'll be working hard to promote global health. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Dr. Jerry Kirsch's long history of leadership and commitment to global health and to thank him for all he has done. I know Boston University is making great strides in reducing global health disparities, and I appreciate all you are doing. There is a growing interconnectedness throughout the world reflected in expanded flows of information, technology, capital, goods, services, and people. More than ever, there is a growing need for this interconnectedness to expand to healthcare. When President Bush nominated me to be Surgeon General, he asked me to focus on three priorities, including prevention, public health preparedness, and eliminating health disparities. Woven through these priorities is health literacy. Health literacy is the ability of an individual to access, understand, and use health-related information and services to make appropriate health decisions. It is the currency for success in everything we are doing in the Office of the Surgeon General. Our nation's low health literacy is a threat to the health and well-being of Americans and to the health and well-being of the American healthcare system. But it is not just an American issue. Low health literacy is an issue all across the world. Even the seemingly simple things that we can all do to stay healthy and safe, such as getting regular medical checkups and eating healthy foods, can be struggles for many people. Most of the preventable diseases that are cutting healthy years off the lives of people in places like where I grew up in New York City could be eliminated if people had access to better health information and understood and acted on that information. The obesity epidemic is one result of low health literacy. Today, nearly 2 out of 3 Americans are overweight or obese, and this trend is spreading all across the globe. These are not just numbers. They are people, people all across the world who need information to help them live healthy, active lifestyles. Working together, we must do more to combat this. It is also critically important that we share knowledge and discoveries about health to our counterparts all across the world. We must not allow ourselves to become an insular community, but rather a global community. Public health preparedness is not unique to us. We need to learn from others and share our experiences around the world. We need to work harder to ensure that functioning health systems are present in all nations and that we have the capacity to deliver a basic preventative and curative services all across the world. Unhealthy populations cannot achieve their full economic, political, or cultural potential. This is why we need to take a bigger stance on improving global health. Since so much of that potential lies in health, science, and technology, health diplomacy, the process of utilizing health, science, and technology to bridge the gap, to improve health literacy, and thereby to improve the health, safety, and security of struggling nations, is such a potentially powerful tool. Health diplomacy will bring peace and stability to an unstable world. Global collaboration on the basis of mutual goals and respect is the only way to move forward. The health of the United States cannot move forward if the health of others around the world isn't what it should be. Lastly, we cannot achieve the level of cooperation that is so imperative if we are not seen to value other populations, other nations, just as we value our own. In closing, let's all work together to find answers that will continue improving prevention, eliminating health disparities, and increasing health literacy across the world. Thank you.
Something about Dr. Carmona that wasn't included in his biographical sketch that I think you will find interesting. He was a high school dropout whose second language was English, first being Spanish, who subsequently was able to complete his high school while he was in service, went on from that to become a nurse, worked in that for some time, and then was fortunate enough to get a scholarship, take his medical degree, and subsequently his public health credential. He's quite a guy. And he's given me the grateful opportunity to speak about one of the subjects that he brought up, and that is the subject of health diplomacy. There are two subjects that I want to talk about, that being one, because it, to me, suggests a very specific and rewarding, wholesome role for every health professional, that role of health diplomat. And secondly, to speak very briefly on that issue of the Surgeon General's proposed call to action on global health. If there is one given in the field of human dynamics, it's that all societies, all cultures, all religions place a value on human life, and that dates back into ancient times. And implicit in that value has been the shared moral perception that it's right to take care of the basic health and well-being of our fellow citizens, our fellow men and women. It is our shared responsibility as citizens of the world, neighbors to all. Now, this given has been substantiated time and time again, particularly, as has been mentioned earlier, during times of crisis, the 2004 tsunami that hit Southeast Asia, flooding that ravaged Haiti in that same year, and more recently the earthquakes that struck India and Pakistan, and yes, the hurricane that struck this country as well. People everywhere continue to want to do everything that is right to alleviate suffering because, in fact, it is the right thing to do. Now, if there's a second given, it's that the health of peoples is interdependent, and that has been true since time began. It was true in the past, and currently in this age of rapid travel, international commerce and global communication, artificial borders and geographic distances can't isolate health and safety problems and concerns of people in one community from those in another. If you needed reminding, this truly underscores the fact that health is global in nature. To my own profession, health professionals, I say that we and you are in the unique position of being able to leverage something universally and globally important. Irrespective of the details of any given conflict of ideology, culture, or religion. And that is the hope that we all have of good health in the future. This makes the global health community a potentially powerful force in health diplomacy and in related peace efforts throughout the world. Now, it's clearly recently become a vogue phrase, health diplomacy, of the linkage of health with diplomacy as a factor of enhancing positive interactions between nations and serving as a baseline for peaceful relationships is clearly not a new concept. The term often used synonymously with health diplomacy is health as a bridge to peace. It's a term coined originally in Central America in the 1980s and originated by the World Health Organization and its Pan-American Health Association organization. Now, that notion, that original notion, carried the idea that shared concerns around fundamental health issues can provide an entry point into the process of negotiation between people because health issues transcend political, economic, social, and ethnic divisions among people and provide a nexus for a dialogue at multiple levels. Doctors Without Borders is clearly a paradigm of how that can happen, does happen, will happen, and is an opportunity for it to happen more in the future. Using health as a primary force in foreign policy and in developmental assistance is a philosophy that might also be called, I think this may be a term that Dr. Kirsch likes even better, science diplomacy. That philosophy, like the term health diplomacy, recognizes that citizens of the world are unified in their interests in contributing to the improvement of the well-being of their communities. Now, regardless of the origin, one thing is clear It's not terminology, but the desire for good health is a motivating factor and a leading political issue for all people. Citizens of one nation can help break down barriers of ethnic, religious, political differences when they assist citizens of another country in improving their health. Integrating national health policy with security and broader national foreign policy can further a nation's global contribution, and I believe firmly, thus serve as a bridge to peace around the world. In today's global economy, no nation lives alone in a vacuum. Diseases once endemic only in certain regions can spread thousands of miles away in only a few hours. Health problems that affect the economy of one nation have repercussions in all nations. We are clearly interdependent. Now, for us, everyone in this audience who is a health professional, regardless of what your discipline is, I say to you that we need to capitalize on the fact that there is a recognition of the role of the health professional that is unique and due in large measure to the community-related strength of our profession. And I have found this true in my career, a feeling of solidarity among its members worldwide. If you are part of that fraternity and sorority, then you are going to be recognized by those who have similar interests in other countries. You can serve as a health diplomat. Now, we have other strengths. We have these special skills that are necessary. And we are all health advocates. So that our potential to serve as brokers of peace is high, and it is an opportunity, cleverly disguised occasionally as a problem, that we should capitalize on, all of us. Now, I would be less than faithful to my own background if I didn't note that for the United States, one major force in being mission-oriented that provides a powerful force for health diplomacy is the Commissioned Corps of the Public Health Service. It was true in the past. I can attest from my own experience. And it exists currently through the efforts of public health service officers who are deployed across the globe and as well as in emergency duty. A matter of interest, there are 6,000 officers. 2,000 of them were deployed to the Gulf states after the hurricane. Now, that human resource remains a potent force of even greater magnitude because this Surgeon General, Carmona, is committed to the continued use of that core in health diplomacy. Now, I close my discussion of health diplomacy with a quote from an article written by a World Health Organization official, 1991, Ulysses Panicet, who noted the following, and I quote, "Until every government develops an organizational structure by which it can identify the health needs of and threats to its people and cooperate with others around the world to address the issue, it cannot claim to truly represent or act in the best interests of that population." End quote. Thank you.
Next on the program is Julio Frank, who's the Secretary of Health of Mexico. And Julio will be speaking via a video. Let me give you a brief picture of Julio Frank. As the Secretary of Health, he's championed efforts to improve the quality of health care and provide, and he's accomplished it, universal health insurance to include those in the informal sector of the Mexican economy, nearly 40 million people previously without health insurance who are now under the Mexican system. He was the founding director general of the National Institute of Public Health in Mexico, which includes the National School of Public Health. Subsequently moved to Geneva as the executive director for evidence and information policy at the World Health Organization. And in this position, he focused attention on health systems He promoted efforts to bridge the gaps between research and evidence to policy in public health in developing countries, and has consistently addressed the issues of globalization and health. He was instrumental in creating the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, which has worked very hard to provide evidence for a new paradigm in international development, which is that if you invest in improving health, economic productivity will increase. But if all you do is put money into economic development, a few people get rich and everybody else's health does not change. Can we run the video from Julio Frank?
I would like to thank the Global Health Initiative and the School of Public Health, both at Boston University, as well as the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future, for the opportunity to address, at least through a video conference, this distinguished audience. I truly regret that I am not able to attend such an interesting gathering as the one that has brought all of you to Boston. The organizers of the meeting kindly asked the plenary speakers to discuss the meaning of health, and more specifically, what we are really striving to accomplish in global health. Let me start by congratulating my good friend Jerry Kirsch and Boston University for launching the new initiative on global health with emphasis on a long-range perspective. It is well known that globalization is affecting not only trade, finance, science, the environment, crime, and terrorism. It is also influencing health and healthcare. But it is also true that health, as a core element of social welfare, a key input to economic growth, and a central component of security, is shaping globalization. Thus, the strategic and dynamic role of global health forces us to constantly renew the discussion around the content and scope of this concept. This is what gives such great value to the new initiative by Boston University. In this brief presentation, I will discuss the concept of global health in two basic dimensions: global health needs and global health responses. I will emphasize the idea that global health should encompass not only the needs of developing countries and the social responses to those needs, but also those challenges and those strategies that involve the whole international community. So, what is global health? In answering this question, it is useful to analyze the health field in two dimensions: the object and the level of analysis. A common misconception is that the object of analysis refers only to health conditions, that is to say, the pattern of disease, disability, and death that defines the health needs of individuals or populations. This is indeed a key object of study of health. But the field must also analyze the social responses to those conditions. In modern societies, such response is organized through a differentiated health system. With respect to the level of analysis, the health field encompasses the sub-individual, the individual, and the population levels. Public health is defined precisely by its reference to the population level of analysis. So we have now the two ingredients to define global health. The adjective global refers to a component of the population level of analysis, namely the one that encompasses the entire planet. The substantive health refers both to health needs and to the social response organized through the health system. This means that global health must be seen as part of public health, where the distinctive feature is the type of population involved, which is represented, in the case of global health, by the subjects of the international community, namely nations with cultural and territorial identity, states as the political organization of those nations, and the various bodies comprising multiple nations, such as economic and political blocs, and international organizations, whether public or private, profit or non-profit. This is a much broader perspective than the traditional definitions of international health, which have only focused on the health needs of developing countries, and even more specifically, on infectious diseases in developing nations. Various textbooks and training programs on international health have even included the health needs of native populations of developed countries as part of the object of analysis of this field. It was the study of the most common infections of the poor and alien what traditionally gave content to the concept of international health. Undoubtedly, those traditional topics continue to be extremely important as we all strive for the elusive goal of equity, which continues to be the top priority. But I would argue that equity is best served by a comprehensive and not a partial perspective. In this comprehensive perspective, the health needs of developing countries are only one part of what we could call global health needs. The other part includes those health needs that affect two or more countries or even the entire world community. In fact, although responsibility for health remains primarily national, the determinants of health and the means to fulfill that responsibility are increasingly global. The key concept, then, is that global health refers not only to the needs of a subgroup of countries or populations, but to the interactions of the whole set of members of the global community. Such interaction is largely determined by what we could call the international transfer of health risks. This is the result of six basic processes. First, the rise of global environmental threats. Second, the movement of people and goods that facilitate the dissemination of pathogens across national boundaries. Third, the exportation of lifestyles. Fourth, the variance in environmental and occupational health and safety standards. Fifth, the trade in harmful legal and illegal products, such as tobacco and other drugs. And sixth, the spread of medical technologies. How do we deal with these global health needs? In trying to answer this question, I will now move to the discussion of the content of the second dimension of the concept of global health, the social response to those needs that include both the actors of those responses and the specific functions that they perform. As I mentioned before, no individual government can generate on its own an effective response to most global challenges. This is what one could call the sovereignty paradox, even though health remains primarily a national responsibility in a world whose polity is organized around sovereign nation states, the determinants of those health needs and the tools to intervene on the international transfer of health risks go very often beyond the limits of that sovereignty. So in order to address the sovereignty paradox, we require international collective action, which is a way not of giving up sovereignty, but of sharing sovereignty among countries. International collective action has been traditionally implemented by several agencies operating on a global scale. The most important of these agencies are the World Health Organization and its regional offices, several United Nations entities and programs participating in health-related activities such as UNICEF and UNDP, and the multilateral development banks. What kind of functions do international agencies need to perform in order to meet global health challenges? I suggest two major functions, core and supportive. In a world of sovereign states, each with its own health system, the key question regarding the role of multilateral agencies is the following. What are the distinctive functions that the international health system can perform better than any individual country because it is more cost-effective for international organizations to carry them out, or because those functions fall outside the sovereignty of any one nation. Inspired by the tenets of welfare economics, we can answer this key question by identifying those core functions where international collective action is absolutely essential because they entail the production of global public goods or the management of externalities that transcend the borders of any given nation. Without concerted efforts at the global level, most countries would not invest sufficiently in global public goods, since they would not fully reap the potential benefits. I believe that four such groups are crucial. First, research and development, particularly around problems of regional and global importance, where knowledge could benefit all or most nations. Second, information and databases that can facilitate a sustained process of shared learning across countries, for example, through comparative analysis of health system performance. Third, harmonized norms and standards for national use. And fourth, consensus building on health policy, which can help mobilize political will within each country, as exemplified by the Alma-Ata Declaration. So this is international collective action to produce those four categories of global public goods. But we also need collective action to face international externalities. And here, the objective is to assure a timely response to global threats and to control the international transfer of the health risks already mentioned. Achieving these objectives goes beyond the boundaries of any one nation's sovereignty, and therefore requires collective action through the establishment and enforcement of international norms and standards, and perhaps the financing of control efforts. Now, these are all the core functions where international action is essential. The second type of function deals with problems within individual nations, but nonetheless, even though these problems are circumscribed to one nation, they may warrant collective action at an international level, owing to the shortcomings of national health systems. Because they supplement activity